This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast. Hello, welcome to Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. I'm your host, Claire, and we've got an important mission this month. It is Brain Tumor Awareness Month, and we're shedding light on a crucial issue. Brain tumors claim more lives among children and adults under 40 than any other cancer. Shockingly, only 1% of the national spend on cancer research is allocated to this silent threat. But fear not, because today, right here on Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show, we're taking a stand. We're not just talking statistics. We're sharing stories, real heartfelt stories from people all around the globe who have been touched by a brain tumor. It's time to raise our voices and spread the word. By listening in, you're joining a movement to make a difference. So today I'll be speaking to Kate Beddo. Let's give her a call.
Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kate. Well, thank you very much for coming to share your experience and also just be a part of Brain Tumor Awareness Month.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Well, should we go back to the beginning then? Tell us what happened.
Put a lot of my symptoms down to lack of sleep, turning 30, having a baby. So I noticed that my feet were really swollen, that my rings were getting tight. And I was just generally tired and, you know, my head ached. But they were all things that I could rationalise away because of everything else that was going on in my life.
Yeah.
And then when my daughter was two, we decided to start thinking about having another baby. And I came off the pill and my period just didn't come back. So I went to see the doctor and he was incredibly tactful and said, we can't do anything about it until you've not had a period for 6 months. Come back in 6 months if it still hasn't come back and I'll send you to the hospital and they'll, you know, give you a tablet and switch you back on. Which wasn't the most tactful of things to say to a woman who was already feeling quite hormonal and tired.
Yeah.
But that 6 months passed and that was when I went back and he referred me to the hospital. And honestly, it's a bit of a whirlwind at that point. I don't have very clear memories of it because obviously I was sleep deprived and had all the other symptoms going on as well. But in brief, I was passed from department to department. They did test after test after test. And the one appointment that I went to on my own, they said, you've got a pituitary tumour. And I don't remember anything that they said after that point.
Yeah, you sort of go into a fuzz.
I walked home from the hospital talking to my husband on the phone. He'd stayed at home with my daughter so that she didn't have to come to yet another hospital appointment because she was only two. And he said, you know, well, is it cancerous? What are they going to do about it? And I said, I have no idea.
Yeah.
Like I heard them say tumour. I heard them say it was in my head. And at that point, it's like everything disconnected.
Yeah.
At home, we rang the hospital and said, can you just go through everything again for me?
Yeah.
And at that point, they explained that it was very rarely cancerous, almost never cancerous. And that, you know, they would do a series of tests and find out more. And it sort of, you know, escalated from there, really. As a result, I was told that I had a condition called acromegaly in the April of 2007, which means that I have a tumour on my pituitary gland. And the pituitary gland's a complex gland. It's where an awful lot of our hormones are produced.
Yeah.
So depending on which hormones are affected, that determines what condition you get as a result. So acromegaly means that I produce too much growth hormone.
Did you feel like a relief that something was found? Obviously, it's not something you want to hear, but did you feel like, okay, I wasn't going crazy?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, I'm quite a big woman anyway. You know, I'm nearly 6 foot tall. You know, I had size 7 feet before all this. But I mean, by this point, I'd gone up to a men's 10 or 11. I couldn't get women's shoes anymore. My rings didn't fit properly. And it was silly things like, I remember sitting down, and you know how you unconsciously measure your own body with your body? I put my head into my hand and realised that I hadn't opened my hand wide enough for my head to fit in. And I know that sounds like a ridiculous thing to say, but one of the things that happens is that the bone on your forehead actually thickens. So your jaw, your forehead, your brow bones, your nose, they're the areas that are most affected by it. And I just thought that I was going mad. But when, you know, when the consultant explained to me that that was what happened and that that was, I suppose, normal, if there is a normal for the condition, it did feel like, you know, well, at least there's a reason for it then.
Yeah. How long did you wait before the diagnosis to then having, did you have treatment?
I was diagnosed in the April and I had surgery in the November. There wasn't any treatment before that because I was told that any treatment that they gave me would toughen up the tumour and make it harder to remove. So they wanted to try and get surgery done as quickly as possible without doing any treatment first.
So they didn't give you any steroids or anything?
No, nothing at all. So I had the surgery in the November. I was really fortunate because the world's leading surgeon in pituitary surgery at the time was in Birmingham, and I currently live in Stafford, so that was where I was referred to. So I had the best of the best doing the surgery, which was a relief. And he came round after the surgery and said, we're not allowed to say that, you know, that it was successful because there's always a chance that there'll be issues. But he said it couldn't have gone any better than it did. And within 12 hours of having surgery, I could feel an aching in my body. And when I spoke to them about it the day after, they said, that's the fluid draining out of all your muscles and your tissues.
Did they have you on a drain?
I had literally a tiny swab under my nose after the surgery. So I was on the ENT ward, obviously. I was really lucky because the tumour was at the front, so they were able to go through my nose without, you know, doing anything more invasive. I don't know how long the surgery lasted, but it was quite a long time, I think. And it took me a long time to recover from the anaesthetic, which I know my grandma, who was alive at the time, she was a nurse, and she said that they were told that there was a formula that, you know, it takes X amount of weeks, months, per however many minutes that you're under before you know, get it out of your system completely. And it was really surreal. I mean, I'd literally watched my face change shape in the mirror in the week that I was in hospital. And I spent a few weeks at my parents recovering up in Leeds, because with the surgery being up my nose and being in November, I'd got to be really careful who I mixed with, because obviously if I'd got a cold and sneezed or something, it could have been catastrophic. So my husband stayed down here and looked after my daughter, and I went and had a few weeks in Leeds with my parents. And by the time I'd finished, my clothes were falling off. I had to go buy some new shoes so that I could go home with shoes that fit. You know, it was really quite quick, the changes. When I'd spoken to the consultant about it, he said it will be bone growth and you will probably just be like this now. So it was obviously caught really early, and it was just the sort of tissue growth. For the most part, I mean, I have had some bone growth. But I was incredibly lucky that we caught it when we did. But I was really lucky because I had my surgery in the November, And before I had time to go and have all my checkup appointments, I actually conceived my son, even though they said that I wouldn't be able to have any more children. So my son was born in January 2009. So, you know, not long after my surgery at all. And I think they were all a bit worried about that, to be honest.
Yeah. Did they put you on any medication afterwards?
They didn't at that point because I hadn't had my follow-up appointments.
Right.
When I went for the eventual follow-ups after I'd had my son, because obviously they then wanted me to go for all the MRIs and things that I should have had within a few months of having my surgery, at that point they said that they wanted me to start having injections, and I've been on injections ever since.
Yeah.
So I have an injection every 12 weeks. It definitely keeps things in check. I can tell when I need it because my fingers start to get puffy, and they look younger than they do the rest of the time. But that, apart from, you know, the sort of checkups, the MRIs and the, you know, colonoscopies and all the other unpleasant things that we have to endure.
Yeah.
That's the only actual treatment that I have. So I've been incredibly lucky.
Do you feel like you can put that to the side now? Or do you feel there's something that still is there that keeps you remembering you had to go through this?
That's a really interesting question. I would say that I try to forget about it most of the time because I don't want to dwell on it. And obviously it's a long time ago. And I'm a big believer in thinking positively.
Yeah.
But I'm also very aware that I've modified my entire life so that I feel like I'm normal when I still have sort of energy restrictions and I get a lot of joint pains and that sort of thing. So I try to be grateful. That's one of the things that I definitely try to do. You know, I definitely try to make the most of every day and be grateful for the life that I've got.
So originally you were teaching young children, and then because of your situation and what happened, you then moved on to wanting to do something a little bit different. And I'd love to mention, you know, the talks that you do now, which is pretty much what you've just said, is not dwelling on things and looking at things differently.
Yeah, I think I've always been a naturally positive person, and I do think that that's something that you're either born with or not. But, you know, even when I was first diagnosed, I was really grateful that I had a condition that nobody had heard of. I think, obviously, it's a severe condition, but I think if I'd gone to them and said, I've got cancer, or something that they'd been able to relate to, it would have led to that kind of, how are you doing? And the head, you know, that head tilt that people do when they're trying to be empathetic. You know, how are you feeling? And I know that that would have made it harder for me to get through that time. I needed people to treat me normally. And one of the things that I realised was that I cut my hair shorter and shorter, the more, I don't know what the right word is, but I suppose the more distressed I'm feeling. That's not quite the right word, but so I noticed that as I got further into my diagnosis, my hair got shorter and shorter and shorter. And I was talking to my parents about it one day, and then realised that if I then had my hair cut short in the future, my parents might suddenly think that there was something wrong, and it might just be that I fancied a change. But I think it's very, very easy to get into that place where, because, you know, with things like brain tumours, it can impact everything from your physical life, your emotional life, things like how quick your temper is and that sort of thing. And I didn't want to wallow in that. I wanted to be grateful for the positive things. And, you know, I've for the last few years, I've always had a gratitude practice, either a gratitude journal or just, you know, sitting in bed on a night and thinking about the things that I've been grateful for that day. And I think it's really, really important to have that positive focus. I honestly don't know whether I would have come through my diagnosis the same way if my daughter hadn't been as young as she was. Because when you have a two-year-old, you don't have a choice but to get out of bed and look after them. And I think, you know, having somebody else to look after was probably, you know, a real saviour.
Yeah.
And when I came out the other side, I realised that because of hospital appointments and, you know, all those things that eat into our time, particularly when you first, you know, sort of coming out the other side of the surgery, I knew that I wouldn't be able to return to full-time teaching even if I wanted to, and started looking at other options. And I really wanted to help people feel better. I suppose because, you know, I'd felt so unwell myself, and I looked into all sorts of things, and I did Reiki training and mindfulness and, you know, crystals and essential oils and anything that I could think of to help myself as well as help other people, but as naturally as possible. And over the years, you know, I mean, I'm a massive believer in writing therapies. I'm a qualified journal therapist, and I think the power of writing things down, and particularly for people with brain tumours, because one of the things that I realised really early on was that I wasn't remembering things as well. And if I hadn't kept a diary during my time that I was in hospital, there are so many things that I wouldn't have remembered and wouldn't have been able to tell anybody else, you know, had happened. So I think, you know, writing things down to help process the emotions and to help remember things is really beneficial.
Yeah.
Over time, we can train ourselves not to always focus on the negatives, because evolution has taught us that we've got to remember the things that are scary, the things that are negative, because they're the things that could threaten our lives. And obviously, when we've been through something like this, it's natural for us to focus on the scary and the negative. But by choosing to focus on the positives and doing things like gratitude practices and, you know, just focusing on the positive things every day and focusing on the things that you can do, not the things you can't, you can train your brain to look for the positives instead of living in that permanent state of fear.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the most obvious things for me is that since I was diagnosed, I haven't been able to do any real sort of sewing and needlecraft type things, which wasn't something I did a lot, but I was always able to, you know, put a button back on or, you know, sort out a hem or something like that. And my fingers really struggle to do that now. And I really struggled at first because I would look at my mom, who's, you know, 25 years older than me, and she can still do all those things without any problem at all. But that's one tiny thing, you know, and I have still been able to, you know, sit on the floor and play with my kids. You know, I had my son, which in itself is a miracle. Yeah, and I'm able to help people every day. And I think the experience that I had actually helps me to relate to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because they can see that I've been through something serious and come out the other side, and this is still my outlook.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, and you've got a lot of compassion for people. What kind of things would you suggest to another person that's been diagnosed with a brain tumor or has had something where that has changed up their, you know, changed their lives? What would you maybe say to them?
I think I would definitely recommend that they focus on the positives, focus on the things that they can do. try to stay positive as well. One of the things that one of my friends told me really early in my diagnosis was to use affirmations. And I'm a big believer that if you tell yourself that everything's going to be okay, that there's more chance it will be. You know, that's such a power of positive thinking.
Yeah.
And there's actually quite a lot of research being done, hasn't there, you know, recently about, you know, the placebo effect, but also that sort of believing that everything's going to be all right. So I would definitely say, you know, trying to stay positive and trying to think positive thoughts and believe that everything will be okay. I honestly felt like I didn't have a choice but for everything to be okay, because there was no way I was leaving my three-year-old, you know, either without a mum or with a mum who couldn't do all the things that mums should do. So I just knew that I had to get through it and I had to be well. So that, I think that would be the first thing that I would suggest. And the other one would definitely be writing things down. Writing things down to process them, you know, processing how you feel about the diagnosis and the emotions that we go through, because they're not all positive thoughts, and that's okay. You know, you're bound to have dark times, but I think writing them down helps us see the reality in it and work out the facts from the fiction, because it's very easy to wallow and sort of tell ourselves a story of the worst case scenario when that's not necessarily the truth. But I think also, you know, for anybody with any sort of brain issue, writing things down to help us remember, you know, the facts and the reality of the situation that we're in, so that we can look back and say, you know, oh, that, you know, that did happen. You know, while I've been writing my book, I've, you know, been in touch with my dad, who, God bless him, is a keen diarist and makes an awful lot of notes about what everybody else is doing as well as him. And because I stayed with them while I was recovering, I was saying, you know, and when I stayed with you, I stayed with you for 4 weeks, didn't I? And I don't think I saw Laura for, you know, a few weeks on end. And my dad was like, well, according to my diary, you were with us for 2 weeks. And Laura came to see you three times. And I was like, well, it didn't feel like that.
But that's really good, isn't it, that he did that? Because it's, there is a bit of a block when you come out of surgery and everything. You're like, what's been going on? Someone reminds you and you're like, I don't remember that. And then you sort of slowly things sort of fit back in, but you feel like your brain's been like shook.
Yeah. And life goes in slow motion, doesn't it, for the first few weeks. You know, I remember the first time I went to a supermarket to go and get, you know, a pair of pumps to put on to wear to go home. And it felt like everybody was walking too quickly. It was too noisy.
Yeah.
Because you sort of, you know, you cocoon yourself.
Yeah,
you,
you're so sensitive. Yeah, everything feels, you're so sensitive and like you're in your bubble and then you're like, whoa, I'm not ready to come out yet.
Yeah. So I think, you know, writing things down is so valuable. I mean, I wrote down every statistic, every number that anybody gave me while I was in hospital, just so that I'd got, you know, a record of it in case anybody asked me. Or, but I also wrote down things like, you know, how pleased I was when my daughter came to visit and, you know, those sorts of things as well. And it's, I think it's really important to look back on how we were feeling, whether that's positive or negative, and see how far we've come, you know, and to be, you know, 16 plus years out the other side, I would never have dreamt at that point that I would be where I am now.
Yeah. Did you learn anything that maybe someone else has just got the same diagnosis as you about the pituitary tumor? What would you say to someone that's just said, I've got the same tumor as you? What?
I think the joint pain caught me out at first, because I knew that things were growing, but I didn't think about the fact that all the tiny bones in things like your fingers and your feet, like, they don't need to grow very much at all for them to suddenly cause problems. And that's something that, you know, I'll have to live with. There are, I think, if I remember rightly, there are three conditions that can be caused by a pituitary tumour. There's acromegaly and Cushing's, and I can never remember the third, but there are three different conditions. And it depends which hormone is affected as to what condition you end up with. And with growth hormone production, it's the same issue that people with giantism have. So if you have issues with growth hormone while you're still growing, so during adolescence, so if I'd been diagnosed in my teens, then it would have been giantism, because that's when you get the very long limbs and the sort of height. And I think a lot of people assume that that's the case for me, because I am nearly 6 foot tall, but that's just a genetic thing. Mm. So if you're diagnosed with it after you stop growing, the same mechanisms take hold, but rather than the bones being able to grow because they've already set in length, they thicken. So obviously, you know, even a fraction of a millimeter can make a difference in something like your wrist, where there are lots of tiny bones having to work together.
Did you have anything that helped? Like, did they give you any kind of pain or like a particular aromatherapy or something, like massaging and stuff? Did you have anything that helped when you do have that pain?
I use Reiki on myself, and that helps me a lot. It's one of the main reasons that I did my training, was to keep my own pain levels at bay. But it's one of my gripes, actually, because I've done quite a lot of work with cancer patients since I've been a therapist. And when cancer patients are diagnosed, in most hospitals, they're taken to a little room and they're given a cup of tea and a biscuit, and they get an option for counselling. Yeah. And there's all these mechanisms in place. And I literally walked in, was told, and then walked out the door. Nobody explained anything to me. Nobody elaborated. Nobody gave me any strategies. It was just, you know, off you go. We'll see you in, you know, however many weeks.
I've spoken to many people who that bit that they just stop telling you what to do next, and you just, there's this, seems to be this broken bit of you, and everyone's like, yeah, what do I do now? And it's strange that gap, that little gap, even if they said, do you know what, we've got these websites that you might find helpful, Brain Tumor Research or Brain Tumor Charity, but they don't tell you that. And it's like, how do we get that little bit filled where people just suddenly feel so alone? Like, what do I do now? Like, help.
I think, you know, I was really lucky, because obviously, I mean, even sort of 16 years ago, the internet was in full flow, and I managed to find a forum that was for people with pituitary tumours, and particularly with acromegaly. So there were people all over the world in that group at various stages. And that really helped, just to talk to other people about their experiences. But I realised really quickly that it actually scared me a lot as well.
Yeah.
Because you would get people, you know, talking about the fact that they'd just had their surgery and it hadn't worked, and this had gone wrong and that had gone wrong. And I found myself coming out of those groups because I just couldn't face being bombarded with all the scary stories.
Yeah.
Because obviously, condition, you know, there are varying success rates, aren't there? It's such an important thing that you're doing.
I'm really glad that I can share this with the listeners, because, you know, they've been diagnosed, or they've got children, or they want children, they're not sure if they can have children and everything. And I think it's nice to hear those stories as a positive story. It's really, and so I'm really glad, like really glad that you said you'd come on and speak about it.
I mean, I was so lucky, because I was told all the way through my diagnosis that I wouldn't be able to have any more children and that I would have to go the IVF route. And I didn't think that was a sensible thing to do, particularly because I already had my daughter, and I have a stepson as well, who I'm really close to. So it wasn't something I was prepared to put my body through. But all the way through my pregnancy, I was told, you know, well, you probably weren't going to labour and you won't be able to feed him yourself. And, you know, I didn't go into natural labour, but then I didn't with my daughter either. But I did manage to feed him myself, you know, for 12 months. So, you know, I think the thing about these conditions is that there are no hard and fast rules.
Yeah.
You know, every time they tell me that, you know, something's going to go in a certain way, or, you know, I'm now at a point where I'm going through menopause and they haven't got a clue what's going to happen. That's the bottom line, you know.
Yeah.
And that's okay, because, you know, we're all different and we all react differently to everything that we go through, don't we? So it's believing that things can be different for you, I think, that's important.
Yeah. Is there anyone that you want to say thank you to?
Do you know, I think my family just generally, obviously my husband and my children have been incredible, and they continue to be incredible. My sister is just always there, and she always stepped in when my daughter needed somebody to look after her, you know, if we were out for the day or something. And that was just amazing to know that there was somebody else who could take that pressure off.
Mm.
And I think apart from that, Dr. Johnson, who did the surgery for me, you know, I think I scared him, because when I went back in to see him for my checkup before I was dismissed, I gave him a hug and he looked so scared, but I was just so grateful to him. Apparently he's retired now, but he was an incredible surgeon.
Yeah, it's amazing what they can do. Like, it really is what they're doing while you're lying fast asleep, and they sit there for 10 hours or something, and it is pretty amazing.
I mean, my poor grandma, the night before my surgery, she got in touch with my dad and was in tears and said that she was really worried. And it wasn't until that point that we realised that we hadn't explained to her that they were doing the surgery through my nose.
Mm.
She thought they were going to saw my head off, I think.
Yeah. Frankenstein look.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was one of the Frankenstein look.
Were you? I mean, what they can do is incredible now, isn't
it?
Yeah. You know, however you have the, because I know they said to me that I needed to be aware that they might have to go in over my ear and sort of shave sections of my hair and things. But I literally just had a swab under my nose. It blew my mind.
Wow. Well, thank you very, very much for being a part of Brain Tumor Awareness Month. And I really, really appreciate it. And I feel like yours is a really good, positive story.
Thank you, Claire, because I do feel that it's important that people hear the positive stories as well, because if you're not careful and you feel better, it's easy to just get on with your life and forget to share that part of your story.
Yeah, thank you very, very much.
This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast.